Welcome to this episode of AI Talks with me, Ian Martin, director of Engelsberg Ideas. I'm here at the Engelsberg Seminar in Sweden, the Engelsberg Seminar, which brings together leading thinkers, historians, journalists, and we'll gather for a couple of days in Sweden and discuss this year the theme, the market. And one of our key speakers, I'm delighted to say, is Kwasi Kwarteng, former member of the UK Parliament, former Chancellor of the Exchequer. And Kwasi, the theme of your talk, which we're going to discuss and then talk a little bit about UK politics and related themes, but the theme of your talk was a character who I'm absolutely fascinated by, a compelling character, Scottish speculator, adventurer, financial innovator, had a fairly disastrous culmination to his career, but there are lots of lessons to draw from it, and that's John Law. So tell me, why do you find John Law so interesting?
Well, I've always been interested in him, well, since I did a PhD at Cambridge on late 17th century financial history. And John Law was one of the people that I didn't write about. I didn't research him specifically, but he was sort of hovering in the background, and he's somebody who was born in 1671. So at the time of the Glorious Revolution, he's about 17. He was born in Edinburgh, just outside Edinburgh. His father was a very successful banker and goldsmith. And he actually bought a castle, Lauriston Castle, which is just outside Edinburgh. And he grew up in an environment where his father was operating as a goldsmith, as a banker, lending money. And as so often happened in those days, his father died when John Law was still a child, effectively. I mean, he was about 15 or 16. And he's somebody who was always restless. I mean, you get these types in public affairs, in government, in business, always coming up with new ideas, always difficult really to pin down. And he finds himself in London. He lives the life of a rake, essentially, in London, living off his wits as a gambler. And the real turning point in his life was a duel that he fought in Bloomsbury Square, where he essentially killed somebody. And the family of the person he killed used their influence to essentially get him condemned for murder. And he was in prison in Newgate. And then he escapes. And when he escapes, he goes to Amsterdam. And that's where he learns a lot more about finance. He's a gambler. He's a man about town. And he spends most of his time in Europe. And this is a time of war. Obviously, there was the 9 Years' War from 1688 to 97. There was also the War of Spanish Succession. So governments at that time, rather like now, have to borrow lots of money. And they're borrowing lots of money to finance armies. And these wars are ever more costly.
It's why the Bank of England is invented.
That's right.
In 1694.
That's right. So the Bank of England, essentially, which was the beginning of our national debt, and of course that's a big political issue at the moment, that was driven by war finance. And Law is in these towns. He likes Italy. He goes to Venice and Turin a lot. He travels through what was then called the sort of Low Countries, Amsterdam, Brussels. I think he spent time in Bruges, essentially living off his wits. And not only, and this is why he's fascinating, he did three things which I don't think anyone really has done before. He was a speculator. That was essentially how he earned his money. That's how he lived from day to day. He was also a theorist. He wrote about monetary theory. There's a tract or pamphlet he wrote called Money and Trade Considered, which was published in 1705, which essentially is a rallying cry for paper money, crudely. He worked out that paper money actually could stimulate the economy in a way that just relying on gold and silver wasn't a stimulative. And it was quite a radical idea at the time.
But he then gets to test these theories
exactly.
In practice. That's what he's
so the three things he did was he lived as a speculator, he was a theorist, and he was also effectively the Prime Minister of France, because he essentially has a deal with the regent. Louis XIV had just died. The French state was hugely indebted. And they needed to find out ways that they could finance the government more cheaply than they had hitherto. So they're looking at England, they see the Bank of England, they see various a stock market. They look at Holland, they see the Bank of Amsterdam. And Law essentially says, well, why can't we do this in France? And the Prince Regent, and there's always opportunity in politics, it was a meeting of minds, roughly the same age, they're both in their 40s, both sort of men about town, socialites, but also with huge intellectual interests. The regent essentially gives him carte blanche to set up the bank. And then the other thing he sets up is a company called the Compagnie de l'Occident, the West, the Company of the West, popularly known as the Mississippi Scheme, because it basically had all the revenues in Louisiana. What they called Louisiana was much bigger than the state of Louisiana today. I mean, Louisiana, to Law and others, was essentially the whole of North America from the Great Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico, the valley of the Mississippi.
So this was going to be France's American empire.
That's right.
Was going to then make France a fortune.
That's right. So, he had the bank. And, of course, the bank wasn't that original. I mean, at that time, we had the Bank of England, the Bank of Amsterdam had been going on for about a century. I think it was founded in 1609. You had banks in Genoa, you had banks in Venice. And France would have just been, you had a bank in Sweden, actually, a National Bank of Sweden.
One of the first,
the Reichsbank, yeah. And so the French bank was just a model of those, a version of those. But the second element of his plan was this company. And that was really modeled on the South Sea Company. And some of your audience will know that there was the South Sea Bumble. Mm-hmm. But what people forget is that the South Sea Company was set up as a way of financing the government. So you basically took bondholders and you turned them into equity stakeholders of the South Sea Company. And the rationale behind that, and it's thoughtful, it's like a debt for equity swap, but it meant that the dividend you were paying was much lower as a cost to the government, or, you know, it was much lower.
But then you could get upside from the shares.
You got upside from the shares, that's right. And so, you know, this is early days of financial instruments, but they could work out that actually having equity and giving people the potential upside in terms of your cash flow cost, your running cost, could be lower because they would have a lower rate in terms of dividend than you would pay them in terms of interest. And Law's problems really started when he tried to create a French South Sea Company, essentially, and through the Mississippi scheme. And the idea with the South Sea Company and also Law's company was that all the revenues from these fabulous newly discovered lands would accrue to the company. And from that's where you get the value. That's the company's top line, is all this wonderful wealth coming from Louisiana and other places. And that would filter down to the shares. And of course, the more the revenue rose, the more the shares would go up in value.
So there's then this great bubble. Great wave of excitement.
There's a wave of excitement. And again, it's separate from the bank. And I know about this. So, you know, when things go wrong, there's always a tendency to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. So when the actual Mississippi scheme collapsed, the share price went up hugely, and people were converting the paper shares it was essentially a bank run.
Yeah,
they could deal with that, as we've done it. The American government did that in the 30s. They basically forbade the conversion of notes into gold. Mm-hmm. And we've done that occasionally during, certainly, the Napoleonic Wars and also the First World War. We just said, stop, you can't convert your paper notes into gold. So they could have managed that, I think. But it was really the Mississippi scheme and the fact that what the government did, a very stupid thing. They said, look, by diktat, we will force the price down to stop this bubble. And of course, if you hold shares and you hear that the government's going to force the price of the shares down, you're going to sell immediately.
The price collapses.
And then it totally collapsed. And his problem was that, because he was a socialite and all his friends were nobles and he was a sort of top, you know, social dog, if you like, they were devastated. Lots and lots of people who were his friends lost huge amounts of money. And then he became essentially a pariah. And by the end of 1720, he'd escaped from France. He had to go. He was too hot for him to stay.
I mean, is he lucky to get away with his life, do you think?
I think what they would have done is they would have probably, you know, flung him into the Bastille. And he would have probably met a sticky end there, or he could even have been tried. The climate turned, having been feted as this financial genius, because so many people lost so much money, and they were the smart people, if you like, the people in power, they lost a lot of money. And so he was essentially run out of town. Mm-hmm. And I suspect, I haven't looked at the evidence, but I suspect he was tipped off in the way that people are, mm-hmm. you know, in unsavory regimes. You know, I think it would be best if you escaped.
And he's had this life of escape, hasn't he, with, as you described earlier, the murder, manslaughter, escape from Newgate's prison.
That's right, that's
all
right.
He escapes to the continent, and this time he goes off to...
So he ended up in Venice, but I think he went to Brussels, funnily enough, after he escaped from... That was the obvious, easiest place to get to outside of France. Then he comes to England and gets a pardon for the manslaughter that he committed. So this is about 1721. He committed the murder, I think, or manslaughter in 1694. So about 27 years afterwards. And then he's restless. He doesn't want to stay in England, even though he can in Britain at the time as it became. He then ends up in Venice. And the interesting thing about him in Venice is that, you know, he's continuing gambling. He actually collected some really quite special paintings. So he had an eye for paint. So the inventory, you know, he had Raphael, he had a few Tintorettos, Tintoretto being the great Venetian painter, and some very, you know, in today's money, his inventory would be millions of, in terms of art. Mm. But he was quite poor at the end. He had a sort of long-term mistress, if you like, who was very devoted to him. And he dies quite suddenly of pneumonia, age 58. But the fascinating thing about him is that for about 200 years, he was seen as a kind of outlandish crackpot because, of course, this is the era of the gold standard, the, you know, international sound money, hard money. Mm-hmm. But really, since 1971, when Nixon closed the gold window, when you couldn't convert dollars into gold, and we've essentially lived in a fiat money world, I think his ideas and his vision are much more appreciated now than would have been the case 60, 70 years ago, 80 years ago, when we had a currency that was fixed very strongly, rooted in the value of gold, particularly, and to less degree, silver.
One of the features of your talk here at the Engelsberg seminar was this theme running through it of international cooperation or European cooperation. It's there in the life of Law himself, but also William Paterson, who sets helps to set up the Bank of England in 1694, who's a similar, different character, but also interested in financial innovation.
Absolutely right.
And then he disastrously, of course, sets up the Darien scheme, and which bankrupts Scotland, all of that. But so there are parallels between their lives. But what emerges is this, it's not nationalistic at all, actually, is this habit of cooperation and travel and learning lessons. So it's there with Gresham, innovator of the City of London, going to Antwerp and working out how currencies operated and how that related to trade, and then coming back and bringing those lessons and creating the bourse in England, which became the Royal Exchange, and then stock exchange grows out of that. So you've got all of this process going on for 300 or 400 years, right up to the 1960s and the creation of the Eurobond in London, which had a European dimension.
So because we have lived with the internet, we just assumed that because they didn't have the internet, they didn't know what was going on across Europe and even across the world. But actually, even though communications were much more protracted and slower, there was huge interaction, particularly in markets, between places like Antwerp, Hamburg was a big center, even Lisbon, to a lesser degree, Milan, Paris, London. These were all international markets to a lesser or greater extent.
And it begins with physical trade, doesn't it? So if you're, I mean, Antwerp and England, there's a big connection there because the wool trade. And so if you're sending something, sending a physical good, then you need to underwrite the expedition, you need to, then you learn how to insure the trade, and then you create financial instruments.
That's exactly right.
Management of personal debt, and all of that then filters out into the state.
And credit, and all of that. So you've got credit, you've got bills of exchange. They're not just, you know, simply shipping out bits of gold and silver. There's a bit of that. Yeah. But there are, very early on in the 17th century even, they've figured out ways that you can actually have paper transactions. If you want to buy a ton of wood, let's say, from Riga, you don't have to physically send gold over there to bring the wood or timber back. You can have bills of exchange and then settle it in banks in London or wherever they might be. So it's a sophisticated system. In London, you've got already stockbrokers. And the stockbrokers, I mean, people were commenting it at the time. They're quite international. I mean, they're Jewish. Mm-hmm. They're from Portugal. Some of them are from Holland. A couple of people suggest, you know, there are Turks on the exchange. It's very good descriptions by Defoe and all that sort of people. Even in the early 18th century, it's quite an international scene. And Law was really in the middle of that. And because of his life and because of his circumstances and the murder charge and the escape from the prison, he's forced to really be a kind of wanderer around Europe. And the way he makes his money is through games of chance, gambling. And what's extraordinary about him is that, you know, look, I wouldn't say lots of people, but there were a number of people who were doing that. But very few of them actually committed their thoughts about trade and money to paper. And Law, you know, the Money and Trade pamphlet he wrote was to try and persuade the Scots not to accede to the Act of Union in 1707. Yeah. So the tract is published in 1705. Yeah. And he's effectively saying, look, we can do it ourselves, Scotland. We can do this. We can create a prosperous Scottish economy without having to essentially get into bed with the English and create Great Britain as a political union. Mm. That doesn't work. People don't buy his ideas. And essentially, he's almost an entrepreneur of ideas. He's going round to different courts. He goes to Savoy. The Duke of Savoy says, no, thank you. And then finally, he gets his chance in the Kingdom of France, about 1716, 1715. And then for those 4 or 5 years, he's a dominant figure, not only as a theorist, but as an actual practitioner in the world of public finance.
So how do you think about this? Because obviously you were Chancellor of the Exchequer at a time of turmoil.
That's right.
A budget that went wrong. A piece of financial experimentation. What's the lesson that you draw from that personally, having been through an experience?
I think that the issue with the law in terms of my thinking about the Mississippi scheme was that the intervention was what killed the market. And I think looking back, you know, obviously I was sacked. I was called back from the IMF meeting in Washington. And my view was, this is just going to add fuel to the flames, because I thought once the prime minister had sacked me, and I said that to her directly, it was over. It was finished. So I didn't really understand my sacking if it was trying to preserve her political life, because I thought the opposite. I thought it would actually accelerate her demise.
Which it did.
And I just sort of felt that, in a way, it would have been... We were too bold going in. I've said that repeatedly. I think it was too much too fast. And we did the opposite of what we should have done. We should have been more cautious on the entry. And then once the things started going wrong, been more phlegmatic and methodical in dealing with the fallout. But what happened? We did the opposite. We rushed into this thing. There was a fallout, significant fallout, and I can't deny that. And then there was the panic and the chaos. And I feel very sad about that, because actually I think that the strategic goal of a lower tax, more entrepreneurial, better incentives for business was a good strategic goal. I still believe in that. But the execution and the timing went sadly awry.
And you thought, I mean, at the heart of this, your analysis was that there's something fundamentally, structurally wrong with the Bank of England and, in the UK, the OBR, the Office of Budget Responsibility, with the way in which they viewed the economy and the way in which they viewed money and enterprise.
I think the Prime Minister's view, which I shared, was that effectively the OBR had constrained our ability to try and boost British growth. And that's the fundamental problem. That's the problem that will keep recurring.
And it's a Europe-wide problem. It's essentially, it's reduced access to credit for business.
That's right.
Regulation post-financial crisis, you could argue, has gone too far.
And it's not just regulation, it's tax. It's actual tax. Mm. So the way that the OBR schools things is that you can't reduce taxes without putting up to other taxes or reducing spending. And it's very much a kind of mathematical formula. And the issue that I had with them is that a lot of the forecasts were wrong. And I even said to the Prime Minister, if we get to the new year, the so-called black hole will be much smaller, because they hadn't taken account of the fiscal drag. So the revenues were coming up. And that's exactly what happened. And the gas prices also tumbled. So there was a gas energy intervention. Mm. But I think, at that point, the Prime Minister wasn't, temperamentally, she wasn't in a place to deal with the considerable fallout, the pressure. I totally get that. Yeah. But I was out after 6 weeks, and I think after 7 weeks, she'd left her post.
So you're leaving politics, not standing as to be a member of parliament in this UK general election. We're talking during the 2024 general election campaign, moving back to doing writing. You're a historian, more books.
Lots of other things, yes.
More books to come.
And commercial things as well, and advising businesses. But my view about the election, if that's what we're talking about, is... this is potentially the most significant election that any of us have ever seen. I think the polls suggest that the Tories will lose lots and lots of seats. Some people are saying more than 200. I can't quite believe that. I think that...
Notorious could even be reduced on some measures to 70 or 80 seats the UK Parliament.
I've seen those numbers, which I can't believe that. I mean, intuitively and instinctively, I don't feel that that's going to happen. But the data suggests that it might. And I think if that does happen, you've got a real problem on the right and the centre-right of British politics, because you'll have a historic party that will have been reduced to a rump. You will have had Reform performing very well.
And that's Reform led by Nigel Farage.
That's right. So the projections that show the Tory party on 80, they necessarily have Reform above about 15%. Because, I've said this before, that what turns this defeat, which is likely, frankly, into a existential crisis is a difference of between 160 seats and something like 90 seats. And that can only happen, the 90 seats scenario can only happen if Reform have polled relatively well. That's what is the existential threat. And this is what Farage himself is playing on.
So because of Britain has a first-past-the-post electoral system, which means that if the opposition becomes divided amongst
That's
itself,
right.
which is what's happening on the centre-right, then there's almost nothing that
the two
centre-right parties can do about
it. And to be fair to him, Farage has been good enough to say that this has been his plan. When he talked about Canada in 1993, where exactly this thing happened, the Conservatives had, I think it was about 160 seats, and they were reduced to two, about 158, I can't remember the exact number, but it was in that order because of the Reform Party. And he said, well, I called this new party Reform, almost as a kind of tribute act to the Reform Party of Canada, which essentially caused the then Conservative Party, Progressive Conservatives, I think they were called, to lose very heavily. And in the end, what happened there was that the Progressive Conservatives essentially merged with Reform, the Reform Party of Canada, to create essentially a new Conservative Party in Canada. And that happened over about 20 years, 15 years. And as far as I can see, Nigel Farage hopes to do a similar thing in the UK.
What do you think is going to happen to your old party?
Well, look, I'm very interested in that, and I've got lots of friends who are standing as candidates. I think the worry is that there'll be a kind of internal civil war. There's always a post-mortem after elections, and there should be. People should debate and ask themselves, what went wrong? How could we do things better? It's a part of the grieving and healing process to examine what went wrong.
And what do you think went wrong? It's obviously,
I think lots of things went
immigration
wrong.
Immigration was much higher than...
I think immigration was a big issue. I think, you know, I can't deny that what happened, you know, when I was in government, when Liz Truss was in government, created the circumstances for a defeat, but a big defeat perhaps. But clearly what's been existential is this rise of Reform. And if you look at the polls, what's extraordinary about that is that it's only really happened, I'd say in the last year, but particularly it took off from about October last year.
So it's on Rishi Sunak's what?
The rise of Reform, I mean, I checked just before the podcast, I think they were on about 4% in October 22, and the latest poll had them on 19%. So that's, what, 4.5 times, 5 times nearly increase. And that's happened very quickly. It's not something that was occurring at the beginning of 2023. It sort of took off really towards the end of 2023. And I think his conference speech didn't go down particularly well. There was a reshuffle where they got rid of Suella Braverman and brought David Cameron back. And then people were saying, well, hang on, are you trying to get us back into the EU? Or, you know, Suella Braverman, you don't like the fact that she's strong on immigration. Those are the kinds of rumblings that you had on the right wing of British politics. And then Farage coming into the election. And then the immigration figures. So we had an immigration figure that came out at the end of last year where it was revealed that 745,000 people net had come into the country.
We should explain to listeners who are not in the UK, UK immigration, there used to be fights about immigration in the UK when it was running at a couple of 100,000, so...
Yeah, and actually we stood, and this is the point I was going to make, I mean, in 2010... The manifesto I first was elected on said we would keep immigration down to tens of thousands. And the tens of thousands wasn't just plucked out of the air. If you look at immigration figures, and of course my parents were immigrants themselves, but from 1950 to 2000, the run rate was about 50,000 a year net. And that was politically contentious at the time. By 97, it had really ceased to be an issue. If you look at the 97 election, immigration didn't really feature that much in it. But then, of course, we had accession countries to the EU. A lot of the Brexit debate was about immigration and control of borders. And then subsequent to that, when we left the EU, there was this perception that the Conservative Party hadn't really dealt with this question of immigration. And so there was the announcement of that figure, I think, again, towards the end of 2023, fueling even more increase in reforms voting intention percentage. And as of today, they're in the kind of mid to high teens. Their average, I think, is about 16% across the different polling companies. And that's something, as I said, that's happened really only in the last 10 months.
And a Labour government looks as though the UK is about to have a Labour government.
Yeah, very likely.
Have a massive majority.
Yes, it's likely that we'll have a Labour government. I'm not convinced that the majority will be the supermajority that everyone's talking about, but the numbers, as I say, are pointing in that direction.
Final question, just back to John Law. What are the lessons that you draw about financial innovation and how it works? Because you need financial innovation. It's there in the story that you've been involved in your own career. It's there in great examples of innovation which succeed, but sometimes they fail. How on earth do you get the balance right? Because you need that innovative force,
right,
which involves risk-taking.
That's right.
But can also lead to
disaster. Yeah, it does. I mean, you can't guarantee success and you can't abolish risk. I remember when I remember reading about the Great Depression, and there was that inquiry, the Securities and Exchange Commission inquiry into what went wrong. And they asked, I can't remember which Goldman partner it was, and they said, so what's the difference between speculation and investment? And he rather flippantly, famously said, well, of course, I guess speculation is just an investment that's gone wrong. And the point about that is that you can't often draw a very thick line between something that's investment-based and innovative and something that's reckless and destructive. I think the very nature of innovation means that you have you run the risk of bad outcomes. Things can go wrong. I mean, I lived through the dot-com bubble in the early 2000s, late 90s, and lots of companies just disappeared. But from that mess, if you like, emerged companies like Google, Facebook, Amazon, and a whole host of other companies that, you know, like Lucent, that are totally forgotten. And any period of innovation does mean that there is what Schumpeter calls creative destruction. There are other phrases, you know, other ways you can describe it, but it's not a straight linear development. Innovation can be messy. It can be unclear where success lies, where failure lies. And that's just part of the market process.
Kwasi Kwarteng, thank you very much for joining us. You've been listening to EI Talks, hosted by me, Ian Martin. Until next time, thank you for listening.